When I was a student at Houghton College, and I have to stress Houghton College because I'm surrounded as I am by Wheaties, I need to stress my alma mater to a certain extent anyway. But we had a college physician, Dr. S.I. McMillan, who wrote a book, None of These Diseases. It was turned out to be a classic tome in Christian literature, Christian medical literature, and sold millions of copies, much to my surprise that I found out just this past year that it was that successful. The reason I was surprised is one of the hardest positions in all of medicine, if not the hardest to fill, in my opinion, is a college physician. There is no position in medicine that has less respect than the respect collegians have for their own in-house physician. Any of you who are parents of collegians will attest to the fact of the disdain, no matter what institution they go to, that your students or your children have for their college physician. It's not that much difference here in Wheaton. But anyway, we felt the same way about Dr. McMillan, and even more so when he wrote this book, None of These Diseases. The premise of his book was based on Leviticus 26, 14 through 16. And let me read that to you at this point. But if you will not listen to me and carry out all these commands, and if you reject my decrees and abhor my laws and fail to carry out all of my commands and so violate my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will bring upon you sudden terror, wasting diseases, and fever that will destroy your sight and drain away your life. Nowadays, that probably sounds like the 6 o'clock news. And our attorney, not the attorney general, but the chief physician of the country, sounds like Chick Coop saying, if you don't practice safe sex, this is what's going to happen to you. Well, Dr. McMillan based much of the fact that he thought that what God was teaching, in addition to spiritual laws, was good health practices, and went on to apply this in his book. And that accounted for a great deal of appeal to many evangelicals. There's another section of Scripture I'd like to read to you at this point in time, Proverbs 1, 29 through 33. Since they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord, since they would not accept my advice and spurn my rebuke, they will eat the fruit of their ways and be filled with the fruit of their schemes. For the waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. Well, back when I was in college, and even when I went through medical school, at that time, there was a kind of a one-disease, one-bullet theory of illness. That is, there was a bacterium or a virus that could explain everything. If you had a sore throat, it was strep or something else. If you had cancer, it was a cancer virus. And there are still many researchers that are going along that tack, that for every disease, for every illness, there is one single cause. I was asked several years, just a few years ago actually, to be one of the speakers at the Cooper Clinic, the aerobic clinic, that famous aerobic clinic founded by Ken Cooper down in Dallas, Texas. And the topic was health issues of the 80s. And in that, while I had the privilege of speak, you also get the privilege to attend this conference for nothing. And I started listening to the esteemed speakers that were talking, world's authorities on illness and health issues of the 80s. The more I sat there, the more I thought, I'm listening to a Sunday school lesson. These guys are talking about stress, rest, exercise, lifestyles, how lifestyles impact upon our health. And those lifestyles and the things that they were purporting really sounded like a Sunday school lesson. That is, if you will, what led to my writing the book, The Gift of Health, which Ed has talked about. And in my reviewing the scriptures and going back over Dr. McMillan's thesis, not only did I have the conclusion, did I come to the conclusion that God's good health guidelines, as I call them, applied to a band of Israelites back in the desert, but much of what God has told us to do are in fact healthy lifestyle. If you look at the major health concerns of this nation, I'm talking about an affluent Western culture now. The major health concerns, obesity, heart disease, AIDS, stress, suicide, alcoholism, and even cancer. The Bible really addresses healthy things to do to treat those. And in fact, the conclusion we came to down at the Cooper Clinic was that if the average American practiced what I would call a biblical lifestyle, they would add 20 years to their lives. That's how unhealthy a lifestyle we lead in this country. And it's our lifestyle that does it. It's the volitional choices that we make. Evangelicals struggle with the issue, why do we get sick? You know, for us, it's different than the non-believers or the atheists. They get sick, well, it just happened to me. But for us, it's what did I do wrong? Why is God punishing me? Where did I sin? Why? What's wrong? I think another way to tack that is a little bit of about God as our Father. As a parent, I tell my kids not to play with matches, because I know if they do, they're going to get burned. I tell them to study a lot of things. I tell them that they don't listen to me. But I tell them these things because I want them to do good, healthy things. If they go out and then play with matches or do some of the things I didn't advise them, is that my fault that they got burned? I draw the distinction between getting sick. I think one of the ways we get sick is very similar to that. It's us going out and playing with matches. It's making unhealthy choices. That analogy, as I see it, is the same as if I took a match and burned my child and said, this is what's going to happen to you. That's different. That's not the way God treats us. He advises us and tells us things that are healthy, and then we choose in this country, in this affluent Western civilization of ours, not to follow many of the suggestions that he gives us. There's a famous ethnic joke we talk about, I have many good friends that are. Well, I have some friends that are Arabs. Some of them are Egyptians. And if you know Egyptians, they're, as a group, they tend to be big, stocky people. The males do anyway. I don't want to say that about the female Egyptians. Get myself into trouble. Anyway, I noticed several years ago, I saw one of these guys. I said, Mo, short for Mohammed, the most common name in this country, I'm now told. I said, Mo, you look terrific. Have you been on a diet? He said, no, it's Ramadan. I said, what? He says, yeah, it's Ramadan. He says, I always look this way at the end of Ramadan. And I saw Farouk a little while later and got the same response. And I started questioning about Ramadan. For those of you that are not familiar with the Muslim religion, Ramadan is the month-long fast that all practicing Arabs have to adhere to. It's kind of a modified fast. During the daylight hours, they neither eat nor drink at all. And in talking to these surgeon friends of mine, they adhere to Ramadan. And they all admit the same thing. They never feel better. They're never more healthy than they are at the end of Ramadan. Their weight's down where they want. They perform fine. They have no trouble performing difficult open heart surgery, taking no nourishment of any sort all day long. I thought that was kind of interesting because it kind of flies in the face of what we are taught, certainly in health class. Well, I'm not the only one that was puzzled by Ramadan. The Israeli intelligence community also got burned very badly about a misunderstanding of Ramadan. For those of you that know any missionaries that work in the Arab world, they'll tell you that during Ramadan, most Arabs are miserable to be around. They're cranky, they're irritable, and not a lot of work gets done. At night, there's all-night parties because once the sun goes down, they can party and eat and drink and be merry. But during Ramadan, in Arabic cultures, not a lot gets done. So the Israeli intelligence community knew in 1979 that Anwar Sadat was planning something. But they were certain that whatever he was planning, he was not going to do during Ramadan. For three very good reasons, or for two very good reasons. One is Arabs don't do anything during Ramadan. They're just no good to anybody. They can't get along. And so they made a major mistake. In fact, they were so convinced that Sadat would not attack, they even didn't have any lookouts posted on the border during that month. They took the lookouts down because they were certain that's when he wasn't going to attack. And they were certain for two reasons. One reason I just told you is Arabs aren't any good during Ramadan by their perception. Second of all, for those of you that aren't familiar with desert warfare, water is the key thing that makes armies function, at least Western armies in the desert. And the Israeli medical community has got it figured down to how many gallons per day of water a tank officer needs to function. And it's well documented. It's gallons of water a day to function and run a tank during desert warfare that they need. And during Ramadan, Arabs do not drink during the daytime. So not only aren't they any good during Ramadan, they misbehave, they're cranky, but second of all, it is impossible for Arabs to wage war during Ramadan. Well, Sadat proved them desperately wrong. He attacked the first day of Ramadan. There were no guards up. In fact, the tanks were literally on the outskirts of Jerusalem. They'd made so much progress, and I won't get into the historians and theologians can tell you why they didn't capture all of Israel. That's not what we're talking about today. But military historians will tell you that the attack was so successful and caught the Arab military establishment so off guard that they had the country won if they'd had the adequate orders to go on. They made more strides than even they dreamed of on the outskirts of Jerusalem and didn't have orders to proceed for whatever the reason. So Western intelligence doesn't understand what I want to talk to you about today. And let's read from Matthew 6, 16 to 18. I'm going to read this again. Matthew 6, 16 through 18. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth. They have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And then the last scripture verse I want to read is Acts 14:23. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting committed them to the Lord in whom they put their trust. Now there are a lot of things suggested in the Bible, and I will submit to you this morning that probably the least observed piece of advice that we are given in all the Bible is fasting. We don't fast in the West. Everybody can come up with their own idea, but I think it's said in the West, at least in this country, we live to eat, and there's all kinds of quotes you'll hear, we live to eat instead of eat to live, as they do in the third world. From the day we can understand English, our parents and our teachers and our dietitians tell us, don't skip a meal. Whatever you do, don't skip lunch. You'll hear on television, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. In athletics and sports medicine, we talk about the various ways to do appropriate carbohydrate loading. What are good snacks to help us perform and get us through the day or through an athletic competition or a day of athleticism or a camping trip. In this culture, we demand to be satiated. The other thing is we love the taste of fat, which is an entirely different topic that we're not going to get into. But we don't fast. And what I want to talk to you about today is fasting. And the first part, I want to stress what is probably the least important part. But fasting, I will submit to you, is physically beneficial. And that's where I, as the physician, tend to come in. But what happens if you fast? They're what I call the three H's, if you will. The three H's is, number one, if you fast, you're going to be hungry. You're going to feel hungry. And that's something that's not accepted in our society. Second of all, if you fast, you're going to get a headache. And that's something also that's not accepted. For those of you that have televisions and watch television, you know how unacceptable it is for an American to have a headache. I mean, there's all kinds of medication out there to treat your headache. But if you fast, you're going to get hungry. That's not acceptable. McDonald's has made billions by treating hunger. And second of all, Bayer's made millions by treating headaches. You're going to get hungry and you're going to have a headache. But the third H is what the Bible stresses. And that's heed the call to pray. My own view is the headache and the hunger are not to remind you of food, which is what the temptation is, or the need that you need Tylenol, or you need aspirin or Daytril or Metaprin or whatever. But those sensations are supposed to remind you to pray for whatever the reason that you're praying. Throughout both the Old Testament and the New Testament, those two terms go together, prayer and fasting. And many of us struggle with, why isn't our prayer life any good? Or why isn't it the way I want it? Maybe one of the reasons is we've ignored the second half of the and. We try and pray, but doggone it, there's no way we're going to fast. What I'm going to do now is make you experts on fasting. That's because there's so little to tell you in the medical literature that we can cover it in a very short period of time. There is virtually no research done that I'm aware of. I admit to being wrong, and I'm fallible like everybody else, but I can find no research on fasting. Now, there's a lot of research on various topics. There's research on starvation, and that's different. We're not talking about starvation. I think one of the mistakes the Israeli intelligence community made is maybe because of their background and the Holocaust and taking care of survivors of concentration camps, they confuse starvation and what happens to starving people and how they perform in fasting. And the two are separate. Starvation is not fasting. The second thing, where there is a little bit of research, and there's a lot of research on starvation, we're not going to talk about that. The second one is there are some very successful diet programs in this country for people losing enormous amounts of weight. Some of you are familiar with these. They're called the OptiFast and the HealthStart programs and various combinations. What they have in common is fasting. But they're, what's a medically credible fast, and the problem with starvation is the protein deprivation. And these poor infants you see and children and people you see in the third world suffering from starvation is the protein deprivation they have. And once that happens, you start to get brain damage and a variety of other things that are very bad. To lose weight, to lose big amounts of weight, though, you need protein sparing. So what these starvation diets have, the successful ones all have in common, is they give you just enough protein to do your body any harm. The third group, where there's done a little bit of research on fasting, is an interesting group that's probably going to catch you by surprise, and that's in American high school wrestlers and a little bit of collegiate wrestlers. There is a group in our culture that routinely fasts. It drives their parents crazy. It drives their physicians crazy because these teenagers will fast willingly. One of my favorite quotes in sports medicine is by a good friend of mine says, I can't get my kid to pick up his room, but his high school wrestling coach can get him to fast. Now, how's that for ability to motivate somebody? You can motivate a teenager to skip food. You've done something. Well, it turns out that the research in high school wrestlers and the fasting that they do, which is sometimes crazy and bizarre, is they probably don't come to a lot of harm. There's no evidence they come to any harm at all from any of this. I mean, there are some numbers we can give on how much weight these kids should lose. But the problem is many of them are growing, and a few of them get very, very sick. And I can tell you for sure that it negatively affects their performance, but they don't do themselves any harm. The best research just came out last year shows, and this is, I think, what applies to our Arabic friends, is the wrestlers that keep doing it have more and more trouble losing weight. Because our bodies are so good at learning behavior that it starts to get the message, hey, no food's going to come. I got to start conserving things. And so what happens to these teenagers is they find that it becomes more and more difficult to lose weight and, quotes, make weight because their body gets trained to the fast and they can perform better. And I think that's another thing that happens to our Arabic friends. Not only are they raised in a desert community, and can get used to getting by without water. But also they learn to function without the food coming. In your body, you can train your body to do that. Another group where there's been a little bit of research that shows an effect of fasting, and this is a very positive effect. Some of you may know some people that are markedly overweight and morbidly obese. And when I'm talking obese, I'm talking 50 to 100, 200 pounds overweight. Overweight, not weight, but overweight. Some of these people have what's called type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes are people that may or may not require insulin, and some of these people do because they're so profoundly overweight. If these people fast for 3 days, they can cure their diabetes. Used to be thought they had to lose all the weight. The research now shows that the weight loss isn't that essential, but the beneficial effect of fasting is their diabetes goes away after a 3-day fast. And people that are that overweight have enough energy stores that it's no problem if they can put up with the other H's, that with the headache and the hunger that we've talked about, but they cure their diabetes. All of us have enough energy stores in our bodies. In athletics and sports medicine, we know that you can run about 19 miles without using up any fat in your body at all. Just the carbohydrate or the glycogen, which is the main energy source that makes us function, we have enough in us to go 19 miles before we used up our basic energy stores. And most of us don't run 19. It's a little less than a marathon, which is about 3 to 4 hours of intense, constant exercise before we used up our basic energy stores. And our biggest energy stores are not in glycogen, but are in the fat stores that we have anyhow. So there's an excess reserve that just takes a little bit more energy to break down. And that's the fat that we have. So we can easily function throughout a day without having to take anything in. So what are the physical benefits of fasting? We're just talking physical. Number one is you'll probably lose some weight. If you fast, you'll in fact lose weight. And most adults don't mind that prospect. As a matter of fact, it's the one consistently nice thing you can say to anybody if you haven't seen them for a while. Hey, you're losing weight. And they always take that as a compliment in our culture. The second physical benefit that you'll have, and this, and I know that I'm treading on a little bit of rough ground talking about physical, and I don't mean to stress that. But this is where New Age comes in. New Age is aware of the fact that meditation and prayer, the act of meditating, the act of praying, is beneficial to us. I believe it's because we were designed to do that. So we get physical benefits from meditating and praying. And I think if you fast in addition, you make that much more beneficial. And this overstressed society, to get the physical benefits of stress reduction, you need to do that. You need to meditate and pray by at least 15 minutes 5 days a week. Now, that's New Age. I don't care what you pray to. I don't care what you meditate on. You can meditate on nonsense, and it's good for you. I happen to say, well, if you can meditate and pray to the one true God, it's going to be that much more better for you. But fasting improves that quality, I believe. Third thing, I think it'll discipline us that we can skip a meal or two. And we don't always need to be satiated in this crazy society where we demand satiation, we demand immediate gratification. I think there's some physical benefits to discipline. And the fourth thing is, if you're overweight and diabetic, you might cure your diabetes. I mean, that's not a bad thing either. So there are physically benefits to it. Well, how do we do it? What is fasting? You know, and there are no rules. The Bible doesn't say thou shalt fast X number of hours or X number of days a week. I mean, it's not there. It just says fast. And I'm beholden to Richard Foster, who pointed some of these things out to me, and I have no reason to question his guidelines on this. But first of all, medically, I think adults only should do it. It's not for children. And it's not for teenagers necessarily, because they're growing. And I think there's some negative things that can be done. And in the Muslim community, you don't do it till you're fully grown, which is probably out of your teens, as far as I'm concerned. If you're diabetic, I would strongly recommend against doing it until you talk it over with your physician, have a clear understanding of what this is going to do to your diabetes. And if you're sick or have any other medical conditions or on any medicines at all, then you should talk to your physician about it. But the ways to do it. First of all, I think if you're going to do it, you ought to do it for a whole day. I mean, you can skip a meal every now and then, but in this culture, I don't see that as any big deal. I think when fasting, to me, implies a full day period. And that means, and this is the hard part, no caffeine. For many of us, it means no caffeine. I hope none of you do this, but it also means no cigarettes. But this is where I agree with Israeli intelligence. I think in our culture, we're not desert people. We haven't been trained for water deprivation. You should drink water. We are not accustomed to going without water. And when it's all said and done, the true essential ingredient is water. We can live without everything else a lot longer than we can without water. And I feel, at least fasting to me, is not water deprivation. And I don't have any problem. Sometimes it's difficult. You'll find it's difficult in this culture to do this. But I don't, brown water to me is the same thing. And brown water is caffeine-free Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi or Diet Rite, whatever. And there's nothing there. It's brown fizzy water. So plain water or brown water if you need that psychological crutch. But it's hard to do. This is a culture that's designed around satiation and food. And it to follow Matthew 6:16 and do it in private is a difficult thing to do in this culture. I think for the men out there, it's a lot easier on a business trip to organize your day so you don't have to tell anybody why you're skipping a meal. But it takes cooperation with your wife. If you don't let her know and she prepares a meal, I think that's enormously unfair to come home once a meal is prepared and say, I'm fasting, sorry. It's difficult to do in this culture. I make no bones about it. But the things about fasting are, number one, you can function for 24 hours. You can function without water, but I don't recommend it. You can do anything any of you do for a living for 24 hours and fast. You can exercise. And if you're a regular exerciser, I don't care how far you go, you can do it fasting. I wouldn't recommend it before a high-performance athletic competition. But as part of training, you can do it. Thirdly, drink water or brown water. But the most important thing is to remember while you're doing it. We talked about hunger and headache. Those should remind you to heed the call to pray. Let me read you Matthew 6:16-18 one more time. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. I think if you're struggling with your prayer life, if you're struggling with meditation, think about fasting. As a physician, I know that it's physically good for us to do. But I think it's even that much more spiritually, and it's something we were commanded to do. Thank you. Okay. Our Father, we thank you for this gorgeous day you've given to us. We thank you for a country where we can come together and openly discuss your word without fear of reprisals. And it's times in these affluence that we struggle more so than some of our more deprived or oppressed brothers in other countries. While we thank you for this affluence, we also ask that thou please help us to deal with it so that we may still not fall victim to the culture in which we live. And we ask that thou be with each of us as we go about our separate days and continue to try and worship thee on this Lord's day. In Jesus' name, amen.